This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The world watched in wonder last week as a popular uprising drove Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak from power. After 30 years in charge, Mubarak relinquished control of the country to a council of Egyptian military leaders. And while everyone catches their breath in the wake of the political drama, the most pressing question seems to be, what's next for Egypt? Joining us to help consider the possibilities are photojournalist Chris Hondros, a graduate of NC State University. He returned from Cairo earlier this week after photographing the revolution for Getty Images and joins us from our studios at NPR in New York. Also on the line is Stephanie Najjar. She is a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, whose extended family lives in Cairo. And with us in the studio is Nadia Yaqub, who is an associate professor of Arabic language and culture at UNC Chapel Hill. And I want to welcome all of you to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Frank.
Hello, Chris. Let me start with you and ask how long you were in Egypt.
I was there for 2.5 weeks.
So give us a sense of the mood and the mood change, perhaps, in the wake of there was certainly the euphoria in Tahrir Square at the announcement that Mubarak was stepping down. Has it sunk in yet, the sobriety of sort of what next, the question what next?
I think there's still a sort of a coming down period there. I returned 2 days ago, so I left on Sunday, I believe. And I think the euphoria is still in the air for sure when I left. Things are, from what I hear and what I'm following with my colleagues still there, you know, getting back to a certain sense of normal in Cairo and throughout the rest of Egypt. But there's monumental things happened there in the last 3 weeks, and I think it's going to take a while before everybody gets their equilibrium back.
Could you get a sense from your perspective in the middle of things what factions, if any, are in particular, were driving this?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, there are a lot of different factions in Egypt, of course, and a lot of people have heard all about the Muslim Brotherhood and the secular young, you know, students and things that were at the center of it as well. You know, I think, but from what I saw in Tahrir Square the last 2 weeks, you know, I saw a really fairly broad cross-section. It was, I think, driven, I think my impression was that it was driven sort of technologically by a young, secular, computer-driven, Twitter-using student class. And then a lot of the manpower was from things like the Muslim Brotherhood and some of the labor unions and so on in this sort of alliance. That was the impression I got.
Nadia Yaqub, give us a sense from a cultural perspective, if there's a foundation for this kind of thing, a precedent in Egyptian literature, in pop culture, that would in any way predict or help us better understand what's happened in the past couple of weeks.
Well, I think that's also a very complicated question. I think in addition to the factors that Chris mentioned, there's also been, for a number of years, labor activists, human rights activists, which all coalesced around this. In terms of Egyptian or Arab culture, I mean, there certainly are movements and forces, you know, throughout modern history, in terms of calls for freedom, you know, the various political developments that happened in the immediately following the colonial period of the 50s, 60s, 70s, the Palestinian question, which has come up over and over again for the last 60 years, in various kinds of collective action, women's rights movements. And these have manifestations both on the street and in literature, film, and so on.
You raised in among the many factors involved here a question of women's rights. Does it have growing influence? How important would you say that in particular was to this movement?
I think it definitely was important, or I shouldn't say was, has been, because, you know, nothing is finished. it definitely has been important. I'm not really qualified to say, you know, whether it's of more importance than something else. But certainly women have played a very active role in the January 25th revolution, or a new term for it, the 111 revolutions, referring to Tunisia and Egypt. They played a very active role leading up to the actual events that we all saw on the streets and in Tahrir Square itself, as well as in the events in Tunisia. And they continue to play an important role.
Stephanie Najjar, you're at UNC now. You grew up in Canada and a number of family members in Egypt. Who is still in Egypt? Who are your family still there, and where are they?
I'm half Egyptian and half Lebanese, so all my mother's family is still in Egypt. So my mother's mom, her father, her brothers and sisters, her uncles, cousins, most of my extended family is still in Egypt, and they all live in Cairo and are settled in Cairo.
When was the last time you were in touch with anybody?
I was in touch with my grandma when she got on Skype, once she had internet again. I was very excited about what was going on, about the uprisings, and whenever she had access to the internet and would get on Skype, I would check in with her and see what her thoughts were and what was going on. And when Mubarak was forced to resign and forced to step down, she was online, and I spoke to her maybe 20 minutes after that happened, and it was very, very exciting.
Well, tell us, what are her thoughts?
She's very, very excited. I think I asked her what's the atmosphere in the streets, how do people feel, and like others, she's ecstatic that the population, just through popular uprisings, the dictator was able to step down. I think she, as well as everyone else, was able to have a great deal of a sense of empowerment and can take a lot of pride in feeling that they were able to force Mubarak to step down.
Is she or any other family member talking about or perhaps anxious about what happens next?
Well, I mean, everyone is very excited that he's gone, but the question now is what happens next. So there's a great deal of anticipation, excitement, because everything can happen, but I guess also a little bit of worry. People are wondering what's going to happen. And in my case, I come from a Christian minority, so some members of my family are a little bit worried that maybe the Muslim Brotherhood would head the country. I think it's a question of generation, because I'm not worried about that. No one should really be worried about that for the time being. I think that the movement was mainly secular, and the uprisings were secular. So there is a great sense of anticipation and wonder, but I think it should be positive.
Chris, during the demonstration, certainly the focus had to be and was on bringing down Hosni Mubarak. Was there talk in the streets about what the next iteration of Egyptian democracy should look like?
Well, not a whole lot. I mean, you ask people what they wanted, they would say, we want Mubarak out. And then sometimes we would press them, well, what about if Mubarak is out? Who takes over then? It's like, and you would hear, oh, we don't care as long as Mubarak is out. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that was probably policy, because I think the groups that had organized the various protests, or that coalesced to form the protest, realized that there was differences of opinion among these protest groups about what should happen post-Mubarak. But I think they were practically thinking that one step at a time, let's get Mubarak out, and then we can. And they were probably in the back of their mind thinking about what did eventually happen, which was a military government, which is what they have now. And so I think they just probably purposefully, instructed everybody to leave that alone for now, focus on getting Mubarak out. And I think probably it was the best strategy, given their goals.
Nadia?
Just monitoring events from the United States on Al Jazeera and various blogs and so on, you did see an evolution of demands, especially in the last days before Mubarak fell and since then. But it has been an evolutionary process, and I think for the reasons Chris mentioned, very tentative in some ways.
Do you think as these demands coalesce and the idea of looking to the future begins to clarify, will this divide along generational lines? Will it be a religious and secular fight? What's the most likely way in which the debate itself is going to be framed, would you guess?
I think that's a difficult question to answer, but I think something fundamental did change over these 18 days, such that there, and again, I'm speaking from the outside. Chris may have some more insights from being there on the ground and talking to people, but there is a new engagement with politics that that has all kinds of implications, which is not to say that a bad government could be formed in the end. Another repressive regime could not arise in the future. We don't know. But there is an engagement that could be mobilized and
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the two problems that Mubarak faced was one that he was criticized as being a repressive regime. Mm-hmm. That criticism is 20 years old, and it has mostly to do with their opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood and the rise of fundamentalism. The economic problems were perhaps what brought him down, and that seems to me a movement much larger than the Muslim Brotherhood. So the question for you, Chris Hondros, is whether or not this does become a different kind of democracy, a different kind of outlook that the old model, repression against fundamentalists, really isn't relevant.
Well, it's true. Also, you know, the Mubarak regime's 30 years old, and I think a lot of the things that they were dealing with were really old-fashioned, actually. And one of the reasons he's fell is because, basically, the world is moving on here. They were so against the Muslim Brotherhood because, essentially, the early iteration of the Muslim Brotherhood assassinated Sadat, you know, with Mubarak sitting on the grandstand right next to him. And naturally, in that environment, in that post-1979, you know, early 80s environment, repression at the time probably seemed like a logical thing to do, you know, to keep down this group, just as we do for al-Qaeda today, you know, post-9/11. But, you know, 30 years later, I think that the acute issue of the Muslim Brotherhood is a little bit is different and softer. And the really crucial issue going forward probably is the Western engagement. Everybody was asking, was wanting Obama and various other people to sound off on what they thought about what Egypt should do in the last 3 weeks. Probably the crucial thing is now, like what sort of government will Egypt form? And I think a heavy amount of that is going to be based on the influence of diplomats around the world in the UN and other places, ensuring that minority rights for Christians, you know, such as Christian families such as Stephanie's and others, going forward. And that's not really, in a way, not that hard to do. I mean, it's a couple of fundamental principles that you can enshrine in a constitution that and back up with, you know, real teeth and enforcement.
Well, as you suggest, maybe the idea of American and Northern involvement in ensuring that democracy goes forward in an orderly way is one thing. But American involvement, on the other hand, was one of the critiques. I mean, the military that's in charge now, nominally in charge now, is, you know, supported to the tune of $1 billion a year by the U.S.
government.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, down in Fayetteville, when I was growing up in Fayetteville, I remember Egyptians being around there all the time because a lot of Egyptian officers would train at Fort Bragg, actually. Because we've been giving $1 billion a year to the military for, you know, ever since the 80s. So I recall that really well when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s down in Fayetteville. But it's so that's certainly true. But, you know, the whole world is going to have an influence on this issue. Not directly. And they're not going to run the show, obviously, but people are going to be watching. And it's worth noting that the Iraq and Afghanistan invasions and situations are going to be relevant here because what happened there was constitutions were written and so on from scratch. And from a lot of people's perspectives, we got kind of burned. The constitutions that were written in Iraq and Afghanistan for a lot of Western analysts were not really what we had in mind when we were looking to reform those governments. I think those experiences are going to come into the fore in Egypt when the government is being restructured. People are going to be more adamant about keeping an eye on what kind of constitution gets written.
Stephanie Najjar, when you talk with your family, do they talk about American involvement both in the past and what they think the U.S. and other countries should be doing now?
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question, because when talking to my family, a few members of my family work for Western corporations and Western companies. I have cousins working for Shell or BP or the World Bank. And they were rather worried about what was happening. They not worried, but were a little bit anxious about what was going on because they didn't know what would happen to their jobs and what would happen to the companies. And a great deal of Western expatriates who were working in these companies had to leave the country. So, I mean, there is a great deal of Western involvement, whether it is on the economic level or the political one in Egypt. And I think that a lot of Egyptians are resent that. Mubarak is known for very little political reform, but he did do a lot of economic reform and privatized the country and sold a lot of it to Western corporations. And very few Egyptians got to see the advantages of such reform, and only a very wealthy elite was able to take advantage. So I think that in the future, what's really interesting with this uprising is that it's homegrown, and it's within the people, for the people, for the Egyptians. And I don't think there is a hostility towards Western or towards Western power or Western intervention, but I think there is this desire to keep the revolution an Egyptian revolution. And
but there is an interesting question about whether that elite remains in power, because if you change the leader but not the structure, that has disproportionately favored a few.
Absolutely, the elite is still very worried, and they're just sitting down and very anxious, waiting to see what's going to happen. But I think that the uprisings have given the Egyptians a great sense of pride and empowerment, and they will not put up with anything of that sort in the upcoming elections and in amending the constitution. They will take to the streets again. So there's this sense of power that they feel, and optimism in the streets, in that they will not let that happen again.
Chris, you have covered other places in the Middle East as well, other Arab and Muslim countries. How did this feel to you? Was this a fundamental difference, or was this the same as other events that you've covered in the region?
It was a revolution. It reminded me of some of the other revolutions I've covered in the past. It wasn't entirely dissimilar to the end of the civil war in Liberia in a lot of ways. There was also sort of a central front line and clashes between the two sides, and then sort of an intervention that ended it all kind of neatly and quickly as the president left the country. So I think in a lot of ways the fundamentals of revolutions probably have the same, going back to the Russians and the French and American revolutions, people rising up and gathering in the square and forcing out the government and taking over the palace. These are probably common to all revolutions. And I saw some of the hallmarks of those things in Egypt for sure.
Nadia, are you hearing from Egyptian expatriates who are coming here or other places about their response to this? And I guess another part of this question, getting back to what we said earlier, are people aware of these elites? Are they on the lookout for whether there's fundamental change there post-Mubarak in terms of their relationship to the government?
I can't speak for the elites, but I'm absolutely sure that they are. Otherwise, they wouldn't be elites. But in terms of expatriate Egyptians that I know, they're very much aware of this issue and the question of structure versus individuals in power. And, Egyptian colleagues of mine at UNC, for instance, who I've talked to. And I think the recognition that something structural has to change is very widely understood. The real question is, how do you do that change? And that's where I think the role of countries and institutions outside Egypt have a role to play because Egypt is integrated economically in a world system.
Our conversation on the future of Egypt continues on The State of Things. I do want to say goodbye to Stephanie Najjar, who's a first-year student at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you for listening. Our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about what's next for Egypt. Joining me in the studios of NPR in New York are Chris Hondros. He's an NC State University grad and a photojournalist who has just returned from Cairo. With me in the studio is Nadia Yacoub. She is an associate professor of Arabic language and culture at UNC Chapel Hill. Joining me now from Chapel Hill are Carl Ernst. He is William R. Keenan, Jr., Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, also Director of the Carolina Center for the Studies of Middle East, the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. Mark Crescenzi is an Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Chapel Hill. Carl and Mark, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carl, Egypt clearly in a state of flux. Can anything happen now, or are there controls behind the scenes to keep from the extremes?
I don't think anyone can predict what's going to happen, Frank. It's really the way that revolutions are, as our colleague Charlie Kurzman in sociology at UNC has pointed out. So we're all going to be going with our gut and our perhaps our hopes on this one. But it's going to be a very difficult process because there's going to be negotiation between the army and groups that are still completely unformed over what's going to take place in terms of a constitution and an election. And I think the most exciting thing about it from outside is just to see how much energy there's been through the revolutionary activity, and people are not going to want to let that go and let this be taken away from them.
Mark, will there have to be a new constitution first, or will we look for elections and then constitutional change down the line?
Oh, I think the Constitution comes first, but hopefully the key part is if, and I think Carl alluded to this, is if we can see some sort of coalescence of a new leadership from this youth movement that happens before we lose the energy that everybody's enjoying right now.
Chris, did you get a sense of what that leadership looks like? Was it making it up as it went along? How was it organized, and how are these coalitions formed?
Well, the leadership that I saw in Tahrir Square was a young student and slightly older than students and, largely secular, again, allied with some of the Muslim Brotherhood organizers. I think that on the issue of organizing the country, I think it is going to be obviously difficult, but it's important to note, I think, that it's not utterly unique. I mean, in the last 20 years, probably 25 countries around the world have been reformed from scratch, right, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and all the Eastern Bloc countries and various countries in Africa and so on, the Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think while obviously it's going to be difficult with a lot of vested interests, it's worth noting that we've been on this path before and that I think Egypt can probably step up to this if they need to. It's not completely new territory.
Nadia, from the cultural standpoint, is this a kind of reinvention of the Egyptian identity? Is that what's happening in the process of this? Or a return to an identity that may have been lost in that regime?
Well, I think it's something very new, which is not to say that it doesn't have deep roots and long-standing roots. Egypt has an epithet. It's called in the Arab world Umm ad-Dunya, which means the mother of the world. This is because of Egypt's pivotal position in modern Arab history, politically, culturally, intellectually. And frankly, over the last 30 years, it's sort of waned in influence. Umm ad-Dunya is back. The mother of the world is back. Mm-hmm. And I think Egyptians take great pride in that, and other Arabs as well. So there's a new kind of pan-Arabism, I think, coming out of this, which is not the same as the old pan-Arabism, which was a sort of an ethno-national sentiment. How this one will play out is still open to question, as Carl said. But I think there is this new pride in in what's happening and feeling of political possibility that's very exciting.
So, Carl Ernst, maybe Egyptians now feel themselves again the mother of the Arab world. How does the Arab world feel about this?
Well, the Tunisian example was riveting, of course, yeah, and caught everyone's attention. But it was not clear whether that would be an isolated event or whether it would encourage sequels. Now that the Egyptian revolution has taken place, as it started at least, there's a tremendous momentum, and I think everyone is going to be surprised by things that will happen. We're seeing things take place in Bahrain and Libya and Jordan, where nervous rulers are being confronted with voices that have never been expressed in public before. So Egypt was the big heavyweight in this whole situation.
Mark Crescenzi, how much of this, in terms of looking at the Arab world in toto, you know, if you look country by country in Bahrain, it does seem to be a secular tension between Sunnis and Shias that appears to be underlying in Libya, tensions sparked by a 15-year-old prison massacre. So there are various different sparks that get these things going. To what extent are religious secular concerns concerns Sunni-Shia factionism part of what's going on? How much of it is this new sense of democracy being part of a global world? Can you sort it out for us?
Yeah, and first let me say I think Egypt is off to an amazing start, and I think that's going to be important in the next phase, because the ability of the opposition to not go to violence in pushing this transition forward really sets up their relationship with the military in a positive fashion, and that's going to be crucial for success in the next 6 months. And I think that's something that's missing in a lot of these other places. And actually, I don't think the religious divides are what are driving this at all. That, you know, in fact, the key driver in Egypt, you know, had nothing to do with that. It was really more about economics and oppression. And Libya certainly is no stranger to that.
Right.
I think what's unfortunate is in some of these places, like in Libya, what we're seeing now, or what we can see of it, is the protests are quite violent, and the use of that violence undermines the legitimacy of the movement, and it makes it easier for hardliners to take a hard stance to crush it.
Chris, when you were in the crowds, was there a sense that things could get out of control? How did you feel personally in terms of your safety?
Every day felt like it could get out of control. There were definitely moments there. I thought I was staying at one of the hotels that overlooks Tahrir Square, and one day we were thinking the hotel was going to get overrun by mobs, you know, and we're dashing back to our rooms, and I was hiding my cameras and grabbing a go bag and preparing to get out of there. It was definitely touch and go every day during the whole time.
Mark Crescenzi, what do you think accounts for that, the fact that it did remain largely? I mean, 300 people did die in those protests, but by and large, given the number of people who showed up, a peaceful demonstration, a peaceful revolution.
It has to do with the initial tone and an amazing amount of heroism, I think, in reluctance to engage in violence. I think particularly the moment that I was worried about was when Mubarak got up there and gave his speech saying, "I'm not going anywhere." And he was essentially pushing their buttons, begging them to make it a violent uprising, because then the military's hands would be tied. But they were smart enough, and here's maybe where the social media comes into play, in the ability to pass around the message that you don't have to make this a violent thing, and that you'd lose something in the process. And it really, I think, is easy to pass it up, but it's one of the things that has made this such a success.
Right.
It's true, if I can break in. In front of the day after Mubarak did that, when everybody was expecting him to step down and then he did not, that Friday, the day after, you know, a lot of people were worried that there would just be this explosion of rage. One of the big protests that day, as they were expanding through Cairo, was in front of the state TV station. And so massive crowds just built up all afternoon. Egyptian army was guarding it, and they had set up some barbed wire basically on the street to separate the two, and the crowds were on the barbed wire, but they were chanting, you know, peaceful, peaceful, and they made it a point as you know, Karl Marx was saying, to not to make this violent, very smart. And at one point, somebody was grabbing the barbed wire, just sort of holding onto it, and it fell, and the barbed wire kind of collapsed at that section. And the protesters went in there and they put it back on again, you know, because they were so adamant and so determined not to make this a violent thing.
Well, and the military as well, because it's easy to provoke violence if you have the guns. We've seen that time and time again here and abroad. So clearly, if they wanted it to turn violent, it's not hard to do when you've got the guns.
That's true.
And they made a choice not. You would assume that they made a choice not to.
Well, this revolution was remarkably gun-free, especially for that part of the world. I was amazed by that. But you know, it's most of the violence that was rock throwing back and forth between the pro and anti Mubarak supporters, and that's how they were holding their territory, was by literal, you know, rock ammunition. I was actually pretty shocked by how little gunfire came into the play on both sides. Somebody will investigate this over the years and get to the bottom of that. But because a lot of these revolutions in Iraq, certainly, or something, I mean, that's the first thing that comes out is Right. Everybody's AK-47.
Nadia?
I saw a video early on that was just amazing of a tank in Alexandria that was surrounded by protesters who got the men out of the tank and started hugging them and shaking their hands. And I think, you know, the nonviolence was hugely important. But not only that, the fact that this demonstration defined itself in human terms rather than in sectarian, ethnic, national, gender terms, that this was for everybody, including the people that had the guns pointed right at them.
So if it's a global revolution, certainly this is a country whose economic woes are in part due to being part of a global economy. To what extent does the reform hinge on international institutions? Neoliberalism is certainly the cause for the end of subsidies. That's when people began to notice there weren't jobs and prices were going up. So to what extent does that have to be? Do the Egyptians have to address their role in the global economy?
I'm not an economist, but I think that is hugely important. I just read an article recently by Naomi Klein about the South African example. And by not addressing the economic issues at the time of the end of apartheid, that the new government inherited all the inequities and really had their hands tied. So I think it's of crucial importance that those be addressed.
Mark?
Yeah, I think you've hit on exactly what is the hardest part of the next couple of years, right? In that no revolution is going to be successful if it can't find a way to start to cultivate a real economy that's not based on aid. And so, you know, all the pieces are there, but it's going to be difficult because initially what you'd want from the international community is a short flow of cash to try and solve some of these problems and alleviate the need to strike and such. But if you can't wean yourself off of that and develop a healthy economy in new directions, then you'll just be stuck with the same problems.
But, of course, weaning yourself off of that means building your own industry and participating as an equal in a global economy that's had a big head start, Carl. How do you address that?
This is an enormous problem, and I don't think there's going to be any easy solution to that. What will be crucial for the Egyptian process is simply to have a process that people feel is representative and that allows different parties to have a voice at the table. Because if that is undermined and if it's seen that the army or some other faction is gaining control, it will really go downhill fast.
Chris Andros, did you get a sense again, you know, this whole revolution was focused on getting Mubarak out of power, but was there talk on the streets about the role of the global economy and what Egypt would have to do to address these problems and how to become a full partner in a global economy?
Some of that. There's certainly a lot of coffee talk about that sort of thing on the square. I think it's worth noting that Egypt is in a better position than most of the countries in the region. I mean, Egypt does have manufacturing, unlike most of these other places. Like, one of the problems with Iraq is that it had hardly any manufacturing at all. It had no business other than oil. Same thing with the Persian Gulf countries, essentially. And Egypt does have – Egypt has tourism. That's something that Algeria and Libya and places like that don't have to much degree. So it has all the, a multifaceted economy. It does have – it is a banking center in some ways. You know, it has these things. What's really – all that's really needed is to take what the existing things that they have and improve them, improve especially the manufacturing and the economy in that regard, and get it competitive. So – but at least they have a base there to work from, and I think that's fairly optimistic. Contrast that with Iraq and Afghanistan, which didn't have those things at all, one of the sources of their huge problems.
And I think if just to jump in for a second, yeah. If you can eliminate or at least reduce some of the corruption that have been slowing down those industries, then you've solved a big problem.
There's been much talk. I think we've used the term once or twice today about the effect of the Egyptian revolution on the Arab world. Are we doing some kind of injustice to this movement and perhaps the Egyptian people when we talk about the Arab world? Is that helpful for us in understanding what's going on there and in other Arab countries? Talking about something like an Arab world, Carl?
Well, there is something to that because through modern literary Arabic, which Nadia can talk about much more than I can, this is a uniting cultural medium, and people are reading newspapers and they're listening to television and they're getting Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera. So they pay a great deal of attention to what's happening in other Arabic-speaking countries, even though the local dialects may differ. And so they are really focused on a lot of the same problems, the same kind of cultural debates, and frankly, they've been sharing the same kind of political exclusion, whether it be with monarchies or modern dictators. And so I think that this is going to be a shared problem, conversation, and ultimately, hopefully, a solution.
Nadia?
Yes, I agree completely with what Carl said. I think it's also important that there haven't been any uplifting political stories in the Arab world for a long, long time. So this is hugely important for that reason, Tunisia and Egypt both. And I think we'll see the repercussions of that.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Nadia Yacoub is an associate professor of Arabic language, literature, and culture at UNC's Department of Asian Studies. Mark Crescenzi is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UNC. Carl Ernst is the director of the Carolina Center for the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations at UNC. Chris Hondros, a photographer and photojournalist who has just returned from Cairo. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
My pleasure, Frank.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. Follow us on Facebook. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.